FilmSpotting is presented by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/FilmSpotting.
From Chicago, this is FilmSpotting!
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
Live from Lincoln Hall in Chicago, this is Film Spotting's 400th episode. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. It's true, Adam, we're looking at a live audience. These people paid good money to come and hear two film geeks yammer on and on about the movies.
They usually get the show for free, so
yeah.
It's the least they could do.
I think they're our kind of people. We really do appreciate you guys coming out, supporting the show. We hope you enjoy it and have a good time tonight.
And I do want to note that we'll be taking requests throughout the night. If you yell out Lake House, Sam and I might come out and reenact that review. People that go way back. That's a deep cut there. But.
A few years ago, the website crack.com shared its list of the top five horrible life lessons learned from teen movies. Number two on that list was, if you're good at sports, you're a sociopath. Some of the examples, Revenge of the Nerds, The Karate Kid.
Defeat does not exist in this dojo. On this week's show, we'll see if we've gleaned anything more instructive, anything more insightful from all the hours that we've spent in the dark, as we offer up the top five things we learn from the movies.
Plus, live music from Chicago's own The Pear Traps, and a special edition of Massacre Theater starring one lucky thespian in the audience tonight. Now's the point where you guys can start getting nervous. We'll also have Slate.com film critic Dana Stevens. Dana's going to join us for an obsessively art-directed trip to New Penzance, for our discussion of Wes Anderson's latest Moonrise Kingdom.
We'll also ponder Ridley Scott's Prometheus with the help of Chicago Tribune film critic and eighth-generation Weyland-Yutani android. True story, Michael Phillips. All that and much more ahead on Film Spotting.
Prometheus, are you seeing this?
Whatever that probe is picking up, it's reading life form.
What do you mean a life form?
Oh, the head.
Changing.
Changing into what?
It's moving. These things moving.
What is that?
That is a ship. They're leaving.
To go where?
Earth.
It was so wrong.
Take us home! If you don't stop me, they won't give you hope to go back to.
Why is that door open?
For the Promethean task of tackling Ridley Scott's kind of sort of prequel to his 1979 sci-fi classic Alien, we knew we needed a heavyweight. Please welcome the Chicago Tribune's titan of film criticism and a regular Film Spotting contributor, Michael Phillips. It's great to have you back on the show.
It's good to see you, Adam.
That's my android voice, you see.
I like it.
Well, let's go ahead and dive right in. Josh actually told me that my setup for Prometheus should simply be, it's a prequel to Alien. What did you think of it? Of course, I can't do that. I'm sorry. I've got...
Settle in.
I've got a book here, basically, to set this up. We'll see how I do. I have to give a nod to Slate's Forrest Wickman this week. He wrote a piece called What Not to Name Your Spaceship, in which he warns the people of the future about the folly of christening their state-of-the-art craft something grandiose like Icarus. If you're taking on a mission of vital, or let's say hubristic scale, he writes, the names of Greek tragic figures should generally be avoided. Director Ridley Scott, who with Alien drew vessel naming inspiration from the always jolly Joseph Conrad, perhaps could have used Wickman's advice. For his latest film, he didn't just name his ship after the Greek god who stole fire from Zeus, gave it to mankind, and was banished to spend eternity bound to a rock while an eagle ate his liver. He went all in and named his film Prometheus as well. But such hubris should perhaps be expected. After all, Scott is boldly returning to the world that made him an international star, mining the material that produced a film that consistently ranks at or near the top of the list of the best sci-fi movies ever and the best horror movies ever, plus gave cinema one of the all-time great action heroines in Sigourney Weaver's Ripley. With Prometheus, he's upped the philosophical ante. The crew is on a mundane mission to discover, you know, just the origins of humanity. So, Josh and Michael, I want you to indulge me and agree, for the sake of our discussion here, that Prometheus is a slightly more ambitious film than Alien, at least in terms of its big philosophical concerns. As this team of scientists searches for their creators, a team, I should add, led by the girl with the dragon tattoos, Noomi Rapace, with support from the sexiest android not so alive, Michael Fassbender, the notion of faith comes up repeatedly. And it occurs to me that how much you enjoy Prometheus may largely depend on how much faith you're willing to put in its creators. For the believer, the film's many unanswered questions and curiosities become provocative ambiguities. Scott and screenwriters John Spates and Damon Lindelof work in mysterious ways, but we must honor and obey. For the non-believer, all the questions and curiosities are more likely just genuine plot holes and bad storytelling. So, Michael, let's start with you. Are you a believer or a heretic? And before you answer, we're going to sacrifice all heretics at the end of the night.
I like this film. It's more ambitious and a hell of a lot more expensive than the first Alien. And yeah, I'd be surprised if there's anybody alive, including Ridley Scott, who would actually prefer this one to Alien. But it's a different kind of thing. You can't go back and remake that film and have a film land the way that one did back in 1979. You see that original now, and it's remarkable how it has this sort of faith in, okay, we'll kind of take our time. The first 40 minutes is strictly slowly building dread and atmosphere, and then you have this astoundingly gory emergence of the alien from John Hurt's chest, which is a scene...
Spoiler.
Yeah, right. And to see that now and how they achieve that, it's kind of stunning because it's just kind of a papier-mâché chest with a puppeteer, you know, and nobody cared, you know. It was terrifying, and it also got one of the great kind of scary, funny laughs I've ever heard in a movie theater, you know. Now, is there anything like that in the new one, in Prometheus? You know, there is a scene, I don't want to go into too much, but there's a scene that kind of works on the same terrifying alien bodily invasion principle.
And it's amazing.
It's amazing. It's and, amazing. And yet, of course, you're thinking the whole time, well, it's a variation on what you've seen. That is this film. It is a series of variations on themes you've seen before. Ian Holm was an android in the first Alien, and, you know, Michael Fassbender. It's not a reveal when you discover Fassbender's an android. He is. That's how he's established. And it's a character you've seen variations on. You know, he's a little like HAL 9000 in 2001. The thing is kind of bits and pieces of all these other movies. And yet, I like the fact that Ridley Scott is kind of a square, old-school filmmaker. This film, even if it's hardly glacial in the pacing, but it's not. It doesn't feel like it was made for itchy 14-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And you know, my son will be 14 in a couple of years, so I'll eat my words then. But even if the film wasn't particularly well written and a lot of its assembled parts, I kind of went with it. Yeah, I liked it. I think you probably liked it more.
Correct. I did like it more, actually. But I'm going to defer to my co-host here, Josh. Heretic or believer?
I'm not a believer. I don't know if I'm a heretic, but that's a little strong. I'm not a believer. But
no,
you're just
wrong.
The movie, no. The movie challenged my faith in the whole sci-fi fantasy genre as of late. I think its fatal flaw is something we've been seeing quite a bit, probably in the last 10 years, within films of this genre. I'm going to call it a mythology problem. So in place of streamlined narratives where you've just got your story point and you go and you let the movie move and be a movie, we're kind of looking at these overwritten labyrinths full of knotty mythologies. There's laborious origin explorations. That's essentially what this whole movie is. So it's kind of restricted from getting on with being a movie. And these genre pictures, they're being burdened by lore. It's this love of lore that we can't get enough of. And I'll give you some examples why I think it extends beyond Prometheus. It almost starts with the Star Wars prequels a little bit. It's a weakness of those. As much as I do like those, it's definitely a weakness. It's a burden that's carried by almost every superhero flick and comic book movie that there is. And I think it's a trend that nearly derailed what was an excellent television series in Lost. And just some individual titles I'll throw out there, too. Matrix Revolutions, Alice in Wonderland, some others that came to mind, Tron Legacy, John Carter from this year, even the latest Star Trek. To varying degrees, these are so interested in their mythologies, their inner narratives, that they don't allow these films to exist as a movie that has any forward propulsion. So for Prometheus, what that means, then, is we have this, let's explore the origin of the alien from Alien. That's a great concept for a prequel, okay? I'm all on board. Let's do that.
If that's, in fact, what he's doing, I'm not so sure.
That's what he ends up doing, and that's all they end up doing. It's this. It's not a launching point for a new story. It's this reason for indulging in all sorts of alien history, how it relates to human history, the mythology of the Alien franchise itself. And we just get really bogged down in this. So if you think about it, Prometheus doesn't really move forward. It just kind of expands outward and backward to a degree. And I just sat there waiting for it to get going.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're live at Lincoln Hall for our 400th episode. Josh Larson, Michael Phillips with me, Adam Kempinar. We're talking about Ridley Scott's new film, Prometheus. And it's interesting what you say about the mythology, though, because I find with most of those films you mentioned, the mythology is my favorite part of those films.
It could very well be a personality
thing. It's
everything
after the mythology that tends to derail those pictures when the plot actually really kicks in.
Josh, do you believe in mythology?
No, not at all. That's my main problem.
Which is actually part of the problem with this film, too. I would say there's no doubt that the first half of the movie is a lot stronger than the second half, but the first half is so phenomenally good, and I'm surprised, actually. You know, Michael said it very well. He made the comparison a little bit to Alien. You know, you have a film where 40 minutes is just kind of, it's kind of chugging along, and then it hits you with something big. That's exactly how this movie proceeds. The same, Ridley Scott's doing the same kind of things from a camera perspective in terms of those slow, kind of graceful shots through the spaceship, and really just building tension and building the stakes and establishing the mythology step by step. I think he does it really well.
It's the anti-Alien, because Alien had, again, this streamlined narrative. We're going to get going on this story and allow ideas and themes to bubble up from a horror flick. That's what Alien is. But it happens to have Weaver and these other sort of maternal undercurrents to the story that allow those interesting things to bubble up as far as the feminist angle and stuff
that. The first one's a very unpretentious picture. The screenwriter, Dan O'Bannon, said, hey, it's Jaws in space. You know, that's it. And Jaws had come out 4 years earlier, and that was...
Which isn't an insult.
No, my God, I love Jaws.
But Jaws, too, allows the dread to come naturally. Here, Prometheus is so involved in its mythology and what it might mean, and they're talking about the big ideas and implications, that it doesn't come up naturally. It's given to us, and then the movie is kind of forced to wrap itself around those ideas.
It's like I wish it were better written, and I'm actually surprised.
It's overwritten.
I'm surprised I went with it despite it not being really kind of anything really fresh in terms of story. I guess I just find that, you know, he's just my kind of square, you know, this director. I think there's, you know, and I'm not like a Ridley Scott, you know, he's not in my top five contemporary filmmaker list or anything, but there's something kind of reassuring about his craftsmanship. And even in a film I like more than I guess most people, that Last Robin Hood, which is no great movie, but
there's a lot of mythology in that, too.
A lot of mythology in that, and that's another one where, maybe to Adam's point, the first half, even if you don't like it, the first half is certainly working better than the second. I guess I find the kind of the crystalline, you know, example for me of why it's familiar but I liked it anyway is Fassbender as David.
He's excellent.
Yeah, excellent, and you have seen this archetype many times. He's very much like Jude Law as Gigolo Joe in AI, in terms of this sort of very unsettling, you know, just not quite human, you know, android. And, you know, he's a really witty and meticulous actor, and that's the performance. And you don't question the fact that it's a cliche or it's too familiar while he's on screen. And really, all the performers are good. I kind of wish they had pulled a different variation for the Charlize Theron character, who plays, in a way, a variation on the Paul Reiser character in the second in Aliens, where he's just basically kind of the untrustworthy company
corporate
rep.
Overseer.
Yeah, who's, yeah. You know, this is a $1 trillion mission funded by a mysterious corporation. Of course, aren't they all? You know, she's, you know, an ambiguous figure in terms of, is she pure evil or just a company flunky or something more complicated? And I guess that's why the movie worked for me in the end, even with all these problems. The people's motives aren't entirely good and evil. And the movie isn't really, God knows, it doesn't have any of the kind of rooting interests. Or it's not a rouser like the second Aliens, which was just pure audience baiting, bloodlust adventure. You know, it was great. I like the first one better, but there's really kind of no. There's a lot of splattering going on in this film, but it's not really that kind of picture. It's all about, as you say, Adam, it's Scott's and the screenwriter's illustration of the idea that, you know, mankind's or humankind's a bunch of idiots for going out there to look for, you know, their
makers.
It's like Meet the Parents, essentially, this film.
Well, let's go from that to Michael Fassbender. You mentioned him. We have to talk about his performance, I think, a little bit more in detail. And conveniently, we have a clip from Prometheus.
Am I interrupting? Thought you might be running low.
Pour yourself a glass, pal.
Thank you, but I'm afraid it would be wasted on me.
You think we wasted our time coming here, don't you?
Your question depends on me understanding what you hope to achieve by coming here.
What we hope to achieve was to meet our makers, to get answers. Why they even made us in the first place.
Why do you think your people made me?
We made you because we could.
Can you imagine how disappointing it would be for you to hear the same thing from your creator?
All right, so that's Michael Fassbender as David the droid with Logan Marshall Green, who is one of the scientists, Charlie, who has come on this mission. He's a little bit disappointed. Well, actually, you know what? I'm not going to give you any more details. You got enough from that scene. But I'm with you, and I know I talk about Fassbender a lot, so it's just a given that I'm going to praise his performance. But no, really, it's phenomenally good in this film. And I like what you said, Michael. I love the ambiguity of the droid character here, and I think it's a nice touch that's different than Ian Holm a little bit, who is much more straightforward. He's hiding something in Alien, but he's much more straightforward in acting emotionless and acting like you would expect a robot to. I think that there are elements here in Fassbender's performance where he walks that precise line very, very clearly, where you can tell by his physical movements and even his manner of speaking sometimes that he's not quite human, but there are those moments where vulnerabilities and even perhaps insecurities come through that makes sense because, you know, the movie sets up that he's been studying these people. He's been studying humans. Specifically, there's a great scene in the film where he's studying a movie and trying to emulate that character. So he would know how to at least put on a show like that. And he, at one point, he even says something along the lines of, I'm here to make you comfortable by being as human as possible. So I love that we're getting a little bit of a variation on that droid character.
He's nefarious and innocent at the same time. It's a different spin on the android robot character, I think, that Fassbender brings to it, where he causes a lot of problems, but not because he has some evil intention. It's almost like it's his programming partly, or it's how he's reading things or letting logic rule the day, but he's this wild card that's really going to mess things up, and Fassbender plays that perfectly.
And I think the introduction scene where we meet that character the first time, it's straight out of 2001, where you see the astronaut, one of the astronauts jogging, and you're just kind of getting to know what's going on with this that very skeletal mission, and here it's a bigger crew, but you have Fassbender bouncing a basketball as only an android could, which is like almost human, in this sort of like robotic precision of an off the walls and things. And it's very simple. I don't think there's any dialogue. That's the kind of minute and a half of filmmaking that makes me think, you know, Ridley Scott really, he's almost 75 years old. He's kind of, you know, he's hardly a classicist. He's not. It's not like he's David Lean or, you know, he's a very interesting mixture of kind of in the vanguard for technology, but also very old school. Like, this is a film that has an awful lot of built sets. Mm-hmm. I mean, they filled out Pinewood Studios in London, you know, five times over, and a lot of movies, especially on this budget level, it's 100-125 million, something like that. It would be doing some of that, but an awful lot of digital and green screen stuff. And there's plenty of that here. But this is Scott's first film shot digitally and in 3D, and it's not the kind of 3D that. Did you see it in 3D, man?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of 3D that you don't like it
pointless.
At all.
I mean, it really is. I mean,
at least it doesn't detract from the film, which it didn't for me.
No.
I like that scene where they're doing paddle ball, where they do paddle ball into the camera.
That was great. I don't know how the alien held the paddle ball in its whatever those are.
But you think honestly think it's just pointless, 3D?
Completely. Really? Well, Coraline maybe would be the one reason. And Avatar.
So some films have used it effectively.
Yeah, yeah. When it's thematically, I mean, this is a whole other discussion. When it's thematically appropriate to the film at hand, it can be used as a tool. I don't really need it. I think it actually enhanced Coraline. That might be the only example.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're not talking about Coraline here live at Lincoln Hall. We're talking about Ridley
Michael's
Scott's new film,
me.
Prometheus. Adam Kempinar with Josh Larson and our guest here, Michael Phillips, a regular Film Spotting contributor. I love being able to add that, Michael. But I want to go back to Ridley Scott a little bit. I know we've talked about him. I don't want to focus on the whole auteur question too much, but I thought it was interesting because it actually did provoke a couple of thoughts for me in terms of what I really like about this film. We got a question, Josh, I know you saw it on our Facebook page, from a listener named Josh Goodhart, who said, after rewatching Alien, I'd be interested to hear thoughts on Ridley Scott as a director or auteur. Does he have a distinct style? I have to confess, I mean, I think I've seen almost all of his films. I have not considered them. I've never written about them in detail. I've never really given this question a whole lot of thought until Josh posed it. But one of the things that did come up for me as I watched this film, that I saw those connections to Alien in terms of the way he was staging the film, not only the way he was building suspense, but one of those things that does seem like maybe a little bit of a Ridley Scott trademark, if you will, a little bit, is his ability to put, and you talk about it with the sets a little bit, Michael, to put things in perspective and to have a sense of scale. And it's something, if you go back to even movies like Black Hawk Down, where he's shooting a war scene, and rather than succumbing to the trend that a lot of people do, where they just make it as chaotic as possible and a lot of close-ups, he's got those elements too, but he also is constantly reorganizing. He's resetting the scene. He's showing you where they are, where the bad guys are, where the good guys are, and what's going on in the scene. He does that here, but what I really love is that sense of scale, where you have man out in space doing something the movie's telling us very clearly they probably shouldn't be doing, and he emphasizes that with the camera by showing us the people looking one way and then the people looking completely different when they're in the shadow of the ship itself, the Prometheus. That's one thing that's this huge, you know, technological thing that weighs over them, but then that ship on this planet, in this landscape, in this mountain, in the tunnels they're looking at, the people are always minute in the frame. The ship is minute in the frame. And he just visually does reinforce exactly what the message of the film is in very subtle ways, I think.
Yeah, I think that the fact that you didn't answer that question before it was posed to you about Scott being auteur, though, answers the question. You know, he doesn't really come to your mind with these thematic things. I think he's a very, very, very skilled servant of the scripts, which is why when you look at his filmography, it's very uneven.
Uneven, yeah, that's a good point. I think there's just the one thing you might look at for a through line with him is that, you know, he and his brother Tony, the lesser Scott, are they brothers? I think, right?
I like the lesser Scott.
Tony Scott, actually, the lesser Scott.
I think that's legally changed his name.
Scott the lesser, and he. Come out of a certain school of television advertising at a certain time, and there's a kind of a cold, sleek glamour to a lot of Ridley Scott's work, good and bad, and he's got kind of an interesting glamorizer's touch. You know, it's not people tend to look pretty good even when they're suffering horribly from alien bodily invasion, and but he's got a sense of how to create a world, you know, based on pretty meticulous design work and put the audience in there. And yeah, I think you're right, Josh. They live and die on the quality of the scripts. You know, he's not so shrewd a filmmaker that he can overcome. He can't make Prometheus seem less familiar or kind of bits and pieces from other movies than it is, but he can really kind of do a hell of a good welding job, I think.
You know, for me, it is a matter of this film. Film Spotting listeners and everyone here in attendance may not be surprised to know that I can nitpick this film. I can definitely come up with problems with this film or things that didn't work for me. Some of those things I alluded to in the setup in terms of some of those things that maybe aren't just provocative ambiguities but are actually problems with the script. There's no doubt that it's not just some of the writing, it's actually in terms of the structure and information they leave out or too much information they give us. On the whole, though, I was really engrossed by this film on a similar level to the way I was with Alien. I don't think it's as good a film as Alien, but I had that same kind of deja vu feeling that I didn't go in expecting but was hoping for because I'm a fan of that film. I'm a fan of Aliens, though, as well. But I guess in closing, any final remarks on Prometheus?
I think the mythology thing is a personality thing. I'll say that. It's not that you can't use that as a tool for a good film, but when it becomes too dense like this, it's just not doing service to the story.
Okay. Well, I think it is dense.
I know that you have a problem with sort of the on-the-nose quality of naming the ship Prometheus, but in the original script, it was the USS Human Folly, which was, I think, even more obvious.
Tone that down. So, yeah.
I like it. Nicely done. Prometheus is out this weekend in wide release. If you get a chance to see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. You can also find us on Twitter @filmspotting and over on Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting.
Michael, you're going to come back, right, for the top five?
If you'll have me.
There's drinks.
Of course.
We'll give you drinks.
Good.
In between.
Good.
Massacre Theater is actually up next, and while we can't promise you it will be good, we can promise you it's not going to be robotic. We'll also discuss Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom with the fantastic Ms. Stevens of Slate. Stay with us.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod.
You can listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from, every genre. Audible has it covered, and we encourage your Audible recommendations. Love sharing them. I love learning about them myself, and sometimes it leads to me downloading them and checking them out. You can share that by emailing feedback@filmspotting.net. We might just feature it here on a future show.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
And it's all real. It's not merely as it was 100 years ago, or a year ago, or 6 months ago, or whenever it was you were here to see it. Now, Madeline, think of when you were here.
There were not so many carriages then. There were horses in the stalls. Gray to black and a gray. It was our favorite place. We were forbidden to play here. Sister Teresa would scold us.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, live from Lincoln Hall in Chicago. I'm Adam Kempinar with Josh Larson. It's time for everybody's favorite part of the show. Thank you. Applause. Applaud our bad acting. It's time for Massacre Theater. This is the part of the show where we perform a scene from a famous screenplay badly, and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks ago on the show, we brutally massacred the scene that you guys just enjoyed from the 1958 classic Vertigo, starring, of course, Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak, directed by one Alfred Hitchcock. The screenwriters, Alec Koppel and Samuel Taylor. The tie-in, Josh, was our top five haunted past movies. Hard to get more haunted past than Vertigo.
We had some not-so-kind words from listeners about our performance, too, as you might expect. Serena Bramble from Salinas, California, said, "You massacred a scene from Vertigo so badly, I think Kim Novak herself felt violated."
Fair enough.
Slightly kinder was Rory McGinnis from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Props to Adam for going for it. Commitment is half the battle. Unfortunately, talent is the other half.
Talent is the other half. I actually realized, and one listener wrote in and chided me for this appropriately, that I was trying to do my Jimmy Stewart. I don't have a Jimmy Stewart. I was trying to do a Jimmy Stewart.
You're trying to invent one on the spot.
About halfway through, as I was doing it, what was running through my head was, I'm no longer doing Jimmy Stewart. I'm now doing Andy Samberg, doing Nicolas Cage. doing Jimmy Stewart.
And yet it sounded like Kim Novak.
Yes, somehow that's what happened. Actually, for the people here, Joe, who maybe didn't get to enjoy the magic of that Massacre Theater, do we have a little bit of it?
And action.
Where are you now?
You can't do this.
I'm doing it.
All right, and action.
Where are you now?
Here, with you.
And it's all real. It's not merely as it was 100 years ago, a year ago, or 6 months ago, or whenever it was you were here to see it. Now, think of when you were here. All right, there it is.
Can I ask you a favor? Yes. A favor for future ones. Just don't be that bad right out of the gate.
I know.
You gotta ease into it, because otherwise I just can't pick
up. I think
up.
That actually was the first time ever that we stopped and actually just we decided to leave that in so everyone could enjoy the fact that
we'll
I made you
that.
Laugh. All right, well, the film spotting hat, not as brimming as I would have thought based on my awesome dead-on Jimmy Stewart.
They probably turned it off.
So, yeah, you're probably right. Well, anyway, reach into the non-existent hat. Little secret, there's no hat.
We forgot the hat.
It's like finding out there's no Santa, isn't it? There's no hat. Well,
we do have a winner
now.
Anyway.
Why didn't
so
we bring a hat, Josh?
It was not my job. Our winner is Adam Simmons from Fairmont, West Virginia.
Congratulations, Adam. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your prize.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
All right, it's time now to move on to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, though I don't know how we can top Vertigo. We're going to try. And this scene, this edition of Massacre Theater, as always, presented by Fandor.com. Discover, explore, and share great independent foreign and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Learn more at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
And yes, we are going to add a little wrinkle to this Massacre Theater and invite someone up from the crowd to sit in one of these plush red chairs and massacre this scene with us. And we put some time into this. We decided to pick a scene where you get to do the bulk of the work. Yeah. You can even do it as Jimmy Stewart.
You get the good dialogue.
If you want. You can try. You can show me up and try to do your Jimmy Stewart. So
we've got
you want to see a show of
hands already.
I don't know how we're going to pick.
Oh,
Josh,
here we go.
I'm going to let you be the bad guy. Pick
first
somebody.
First one to stand up. Ooh. Right there in the middle.
Come on up. Applause. All right, so we have to do the obligatory
script, right?
Chit-chat. I may give him a script. We'll see.
I like improv.
Good. Okay.
Chicago.
We don't. We're not good at that. But first, for the crowd and for our benefit, what's your name?
Anand Sarwate.
And where are you from?
From Chicago.
Okay, fantastic. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but why are you here? How long have you been listening to Film Spotting?
Actually,
hopefully some amount of time.
Only since about January, because my friend Ursula, who came here with...
Perfect.
She has been a long-time listener. So.
Well, thank you, Ursula. We appreciate that. All right, let's go ahead with this scene. I have your side, as they say in the Ooh. Business. And you are the listener in this scene. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Do you want to give it a quick read first?
Maybe.
Okay.
Josh, are you ready?
No.
Okay, well... You're going to lead us off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
I don't have that one. I'll buy it for 40.
Sold.
Now, why would you sell it to me and not to him?
Because you're not a geek.
You guys are snobs.
No, we're not.
Yeah, seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars, so you crap on people who know lesser than you.
No.
Which is everybody.
Yeah.
It's just sad.
And scene. All
that
right,
very
let's hear it. Nicely done. Nicely done. Nicely done. If you know what scene we just not so brutally massacred this time, thanks to our listener, email feedback@filmspotting.net with your name, location, and the movie's title. Your deadline is going to be June 12th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Dear Mr. Vernon,
We accept the fact that we had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are. And you see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, with the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain, and an athlete,
and a basket case, a princess,
and a criminal. Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
All right, so on our last show, our poll question, we were looking ahead to this big 400th episode, and we asked you on our website, filmspotting.net, what other 400 are you most likely to celebrate in your lifetime? And we wanted to basically get a sense of how our cinephile audience here and online, obviously, how they fit into those archetypes that you just heard from The Breakfast Club. And before we get to those online results, Josh, let's just do a little bit of a show of hands. As I read the options for what other 400 you're most likely to celebrate in your lifetime, I want you to applaud for the one that best fits you. Again, the question, what other 400 are you most likely to celebrate? Are you the brain, like Anthony Michael Hall, most likely to celebrate your 400th viewing of Star Wars? Wow. No geeks here tonight. Okay. Are you, I hope there's no criminals here tonight, Judd Nelson, most likely to celebrate your 400th viewing of The Big Lebowski? Okay. Any basket cases? Ali Sheedy, most likely to celebrate your 400th viewing of Mulholland Drive? Dana, basket case, I can see it. Are you the athlete, Emilio Estevez, most likely to celebrate your 400th viewing of Rocky? I mean, yeah, it shouldn't have won the Oscar, okay, but it's not that bad. Wow. Or are you the princess slash virgin, as we're using it, the cinephile virgin, like Molly Ringwald, most likely to celebrate your first viewing of The 400 Blows, the Truffaut film? Okay, so we've got some hardcore cinephiles in the audience. I don't know, sounds like a Lebowski crowd, Mulholland Drive crowd.
It's pretty reflective of the results, actually.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, single Rocky guy. 2% of film spotters selected Rocky. 400th viewing of Mulholland Drive, 13%. The first viewing of The 400 Blows came in with 26%. And at 28% was the 400th viewing of Star Wars, but winning with 31%, the 400th viewing of The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
The criminals.
I can't really argue with that. Kind of figured it would end up that way. And I am maybe just a little bit surprised we didn't have a little bit more of a pro-Star Wars crowd. I also think the results are a little bit skewed by the fact that some people maybe misunderstood the question a little bit, probably from my poor wording, and thought that you were voting for The 400 Blows because that's your favorite film of the bunch. And hey, I love Truffaut as well, but no, it was actually your first viewing of The 400 Blows. So who knows how the film spotting landscape
really
shakes
out. Maybe
people
have seen Star Wars like 800 times, and that's why they couldn't vote for that.
Fair enough. That's possible, actually. Well, this week's poll question, of course, we're going to look ahead to our next show, though I'm not sure I actually want to do a next show. Can we just take another week off maybe before we do Film Spotting 401? But we're planning on that show to talk about the new film, Safety Not Guaranteed. And that's a film starring my guy, Mark Duplass, where he plays a wannabe time traveler. He claims that he has invented a time machine and invites someone to come along and go traveling with him. They have to bring their own weapons, as the ad says in the magazine. So we're thinking about that, and we thought a good top five that fit in there was crackpots, movie crackpots. And we even are going to add the wrinkle that they kind of have to know what they're talking about. They're not just totally crazy. They're not totally off their rocker. Everyone thinks they're nuts, but they may just be onto something.
Are we still debating whether or not they have to succeed? I mean, I know this
we'll debate that. Not here live. So
all right,
let's get into our options. This is a patented Sam Van Halgren special poll question. Would you rather, Josh?
Would you rather bus ghosts with Peter Venkman and friends or ride shotgun in Doc Brown's DeLorean?
This is a tough one. Really, I mean, if you're into arbitrary poll questions that mean nothing, as I am, this is a really hard question.
You'll have many sleepless nights over
this. Probably will. But crackpots, it doesn't get much better than Doc Brown. And, of course, we think about the Ghostbusters, everyone underestimating them, not believing what they're selling. But, of course, they're legit. So you think immediately when I see this poll question, I think it's got to be Back to the Future. It's got to be I want to be in the DeLorean, because how could you pass up time traveling? But then you'd be passing up a chance to hang with Bill Murray. And that might actually be better. So let's actually go to the crowd. So First option, Bus Ghosts with Peter Venkman and friends. That's a lot. What about Hang Out with Doc Brown and his DeLorean?
I don't know. One of the lessons that almost made my top five was you don't mess around with time travel from the movies. It never turns out well. So
wow. I knew a lot of people love Back to the Future, as I do, and that was decisive. Well, thank you, everyone, for your vote. We want to know what everyone around the world listening to Film Spotting thinks. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
What kind of bird are you?
I'm a sparrow. She's a dove.
No, I said, what kind of bird are you?
Dear Susie, here's my plan.
Dear Sam, my answer is yes.
Dear Susie, one.
Dear Sam, where?
Dear Susie, walk 400 yards due north from your house to the dirt path which has not got any name on it. Turn right and follow to the end. I will meet you in the meadow.
Who's missing? Shukuski, you in there? Jiminy Cricket, he flew the coop.
All right, that's the trailer for Moonrise Kingdom. It opened in New York and L.A. a couple weeks back and just expanded to Chicago and other select cities last weekend to help us navigate the indelible and impeccably designed world of Wes Anderson. Please welcome from Slate.com the impeccable, indelible Dana Stevens. All the way from New York City, I might add. That's how big this 400th episode is. Thank you so much, Dana.
So great to
Is this
see
your
here.
First time in Chicago? Or just haven't
no,
been here for a
I've
while?
I've been to Chicago twice. And I was saying to Michael, I was here once when it was too hot and once when it was too cold. So I'm finally here for the perfect Chicago
well,
weather.
Well, it's great to have you.
I've never met Dana until tonight. So what better way than in front of a live audience? That's not awkward at all, is it?
Oh, I wanted you guys to know I brought you some water because you seem so hot and so stranded up here without anything to
I'm
drink.
I'm a little parched.
So please,
thank you.
Yes?
Thank you.
Yeah. Please partake.
I appreciate it.
All right. So Moonrise Kingdom. The list of repeated tropes from Wes Anderson films have become so familiar to moviegoers that your home base, Slate.com, actually put together a bingo game which you could win by spotting familiar elements as you watch Wes Anderson movies. So 1960s Britpop, symmetrical framing, tan suit jackets, all that sort of stuff. Moonrise Kingdom is Anderson's latest. It's the opening film. It was the opening film at the recent Cannes Film Festival. It's open here in Chicago. How many, just by applause, have seen it already? Good. All right. So this certainly has a lot of the same elements as his other films. And while it's telling, as we saw from the trailer, the tale of two preteens in 1965, who meet on New England vacation island and run away together. So these repeated motifs exhaust some critics, but I find them increasingly endearing. And in fact, Moonrise Kingdom even clarified one of Anderson's obsessions for me. But how about you, Dana? I'm wondering if the movie put anything particular into focus for you when you think about it in terms of Anderson's filmography, or was this simply more of the same old Wes?
Yeah, I'm interested to talk about this with you guys because I've now already reviewed this movie and talked about it in my own podcast, This Late Culture Gabfest, and I still feel like I haven't quite come to peace with this movie, and I'm really intrigued by the way that every discussion about a Wes Anderson movie always turns into a referendum on Wes Anderson. I mean, that's somewhat true of any director with a very distinctive style, and that was somewhat true of Ridley Scott in your discussion just now, but I think with Anderson it's particularly marked. Because I can't think of any other director that's created his own universe with its own laws and its own kind of aesthetic regimentation to the degree that he has. I kind of feel like Moonrise Kingdom is maybe the movie where I've come to terms with just letting Wes Anderson be Wes Anderson.
Okay.
But then again, he could still blow it. I mean, I think up until Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is his last movie before this one, correct? I was feeling like it was diminishing returns from him. I really loved Rushmore. And I felt that every movie since then was sort of getting more wrapped up in the tics and less accessible to the viewer and less emotionally accessible in terms of the dramatic conflict. And then Fantastic Mr. Fox came along and blew me away. I love that movie, absolutely love it, and feel like it's really the best work that he's done. And maybe because the stakes are a little bit lower here and it's a romance between two kids and he's not messing with some of the same deeper, darker stuff that he was, for example, in The Darjeeling Express, a movie that really didn't work for me at all. I'm at peace with Moonrise Kingdom. I feel like it's one of those things. It's one of those movies that reliably delivers those packets of Wes Anderson pleasure, right? The soundtrack is incredible. I've now bought the soundtrack on iTunes and listened to it day and night because it's just beautiful the way he uses classical music. He uses all this Benjamin Britten that you heard in the trailer just now and kind of structures the movie around this big choral piece by Benjamin Britten. And he's so incredibly meticulous in the way that he lays these things in place that I do think that it goes beyond just style, that he's a guy who has a nice style but no substance. The style sort of is the substance with him, right? But at the same time, and a lot of you have seen Moonrise Kingdom, so you know what I mean, I just don't think that that romance between those two kids is particularly dramatically interesting. And it really, really needs to be for us to get caught up in this movie and the passion of that central story the way that we're supposed to.
This is Film Spotting's live 400th show. I'm Josh Larson, along with special guest critic Dana Stevens of Slate and Film Spotting mastermind Adam Kempinar. What was your take, Adam? Did you appreciate anything new about Anderson with Moonrise Kingdom?
I did, actually, and part of it I got from reading your review. I thought you had a really nice insight, and I'll go ahead and let you share that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, for once. It's been 5 months.
Does it make up for Prometheus?
Almost. It almost makes up for Prometheus. But I think that the big thing, I think you're going to touch on the sense of community, I think, is something that's really interesting with this film. But also, Dana, I disagree about the love story, about the coming-of-age tale here. It actually really worked for me, and part of it is I thought those performances, and it is a high-wire act when you're doing a Wes Anderson film where you have to do that deadpan style and you have to be very precise about it. It's almost its own kind of mammoth thing in some ways, and I think that these two young actors actually do a really good job with it. And I felt like you don't have to buy their love story in any conventional way because right from the beginning of this film, this is such a fable. It's such a fairy tale, and I really never got the sense that we were supposed to buy that this wasn't necessarily true love, and these are two people who are going to spend the rest of their lives together. This is a summer. This is where they're at in their lives now. And what's more important is you have two people coming together who what they see in the other person is someone like them. Simply they're that outsider, kind of stereotypical Wes Anderson character who finally meets someone who is a little bit damaged like them in a place where everyone else doesn't seem as damaged, and they connect. And that connection was one of the strengths of the film for me.
I think we do have a clip of the two kids in the film, so we'll take a look at that.
Were you followed?
I doubt it.
Good. Is that a cat in there? Can you read a map?
Uh-huh.
I do cartography. I feel we should go halfway today and halfway tomorrow since you're a less experienced hiker and you're wearing Sunday school shoes.
They're not really Sunday school shoes.
Thank you. Here's where we are right now. I'd like to pitch camp here by 1600, which means 4 o'clock. How's that sound?
Fine.
You want some beef jerky?
Okay.
Let's go.
I think you're onto something, Dana, with the kids, because there's something very particular about Anderson's diction, and to put that in the hands of child actors is pretty brave, because you have to really be the right sort of actor to be able to pull that off. And it's one thing that's been interesting throughout his career is to see which of his new ensemble members fit that better than others. And we could even talk about that with this cast because there's some new faces. But the kids, they're good. They've got it. But maybe then that emotional element doesn't quite come through as much as maybe we wish it would. It didn't bother me because I kind of saw that as secondary. Speaking to what Adam mentioned with this idea of community, that's the thing that came into focus for me. All of Anderson's films, we think of them as ensemble pictures, but they're really pictures of communities. And it could be friendship in Bottle Rocket, or often it's a family, you know, Royal Tenenbaums. Here it's a very specific idea of community like we usually think about it, you know, people in a bordered space. And so it really gave him the opportunity to explore that. And I even saw Susie and Sam being sort of the catalyst for this community to reconsider their place in relation to each other. Their adventure, their running away, throws everyone into a panic. And as we watch them do that, various characters reconsider what their role was. So even Susie's mom, who's played Frances McDormand, who fits perfectly in the Anderson ensemble, I'd argue, you know, she kind of reconsiders. She's been dallying with the police chief on the island, and she reconsiders that in the light of this and returns to her role as a wife and mother as she watches her family crumbling. Scoutmaster Ward, who Edward Norton plays, he has this kind of epiphany moment. He says he's a school teacher during the year, but he's a scoutmaster in the summer, and no one really asks him, but he just
realizes it and makes this announcement that I think of myself as a scoutmaster first. And so he kind of establishes himself there in his mind. But the movie gives him a chance to heroically prove it later. So if you almost look at each of the figures here, because of these kids running away and the trauma, they're kind of forced to reconsider where they are on this island and who they are.
I agree that Ed Norton completely masters that oblique, deadpan Wes Anderson tone. Yeah, I really don't think the kids do, but maybe you could work around that because there is so much else going on in the movie. As you say, it is this big ensemble piece. But yeah, to me, if we don't believe in that romance between the two kids, not necessarily that they're going to stay together for the rest of their lives, right? But that at least they're sort of like, as we were rooting for them as much as we're rooting for Diane Lane and the kid that she's with in A Little Romance, right? I didn't feel that they had that kind of forward movement, the kids.
I was rooting for them, definitely, but I think part of it, the reason why or why it worked for me more, gets to what Josh was saying. It's really interesting how, and I hadn't really thought of the film this way before, but it is almost about everyone else but them. Their story is almost, even though it's the driving force of the film, it's completely secondary to what their running away causes in everyone else. It's about how everyone else starts to reevaluate themselves and change. They don't really change much from the start of the film to the end. They finally found someone, as I said, who they can connect with, and that's important. And you think by the end of the film, they're both in better places, no doubt, than they were at the start. But I don't think some of them have gone through as much emotionally as everyone else in the film.
But does anyone in this film really go through that much emotionally? I mean, don't you guys find...
It's a Wes Anderson film.
Here's where I hit the limit with Wes Anderson. It's like, it's so exquisite, and I can just sit there and get so much pleasure out of just the... Not just the visuals, but sort of the nesting, you know, the Chinese box style nesting of sort of one visual into another and one theme into another and all of that. But that kind of emotional obliqueness ultimately, I think, is really hindering him from growing as an artist. And that sounds so hokey, but there's always has to be this moment when emotion is deflected. Like, if you remember, I don't want to spoil anything for those who haven't seen it, but the moment that that Sam, the kid, right, played by Jared Gilman, is that the actor's name?
Mm-hmm.
Is sitting with Edward Norton there in the hold of the boat. It's after the kids have been found and the romantic idol and taken away by the adults, and they're going to be separated forever, supposedly. And Edward Norton sort of asks him, you know, what happened with your family? He's an orphan, Sam. And what's happening with your foster family? He starts to actually sort of probe into some of the trauma of this kid's life. And there's this very clear emotional beat where the kid just refuses to answer and Ed Norton doesn't push it. And I can't remember exactly what the line is now, but it was just this moment that I realized Wes Anderson is not going to go there. He's really not. He's going to ask for the pathos for, you know, that we're going to have this pathos for this kid, but he's not actually going to explore or investigate anything about his past.
I find the emotions in the oblique moments. You're right. It's almost like he doesn't push that moment, but it'll somehow come out later when you least expect it. These movies really, it's funny that people consider them distancing and say Anderson is cold, because they really affect me emotionally like no other tearjerkers do. Other movies where I can sense the manipulation do. There will be a moment in almost every Wes Anderson film where all of a sudden I feel like crying. And sometimes I do, and I don't quite understand that, but I think part of it is the unexpectedness. And here, it's the climax where the two kids have, I don't want to give too much away, but basically they've reconnected and they're making their final flee. And there's a moment of decision there, and it's just a little moment where Sam looks to Susie for her consent and a crucial decision he's going to make. And for some reason, his turning to her and asking for her input in this crucial decision, that's when it all came into me. It's like, wow, this kid has been processing all this. He's been listening. He's not just some goofy kid wearing weird getup, but he's really struggling with what's going on here. And that's where we see it. That little look to her, this crucial decision, that's where it hits me. So I understand how we don't have those powerhouse emotional scenes, but I think there are such amazing nuggets in his movies where the emotion is really strong.
Wow, I must be really emotionally un-nuanced because whenever
Dane
the kids
is
were
the
interacting...
Android, actually. Weyland Yutani, I see it. There's a barcode.
Yeah, just take my head and twist it right off.
Well, actually, as we're talking about Moonrise Kingdom here, the latest film from Wes Anderson, you're listening to Film Spotting, our 400th episode live at Lincoln Hall with Josh Larson. Yes, I'm Adam Kempinar. Dana Stevens from Slate is here with us as well. And not to try to contradict what you were saying, Josh, because I think it was really, even if I'm more with Dana in terms of not having that emotional reaction, I thought it was very well expressed, and I wish I I wish I had those teary moments at Wes Anderson films.
I get teary at the aesthetics of Wes Anderson movies. And I mean, I will actually cry because the music is so beautiful.
That's a good point. Yeah. And I think it was interesting because as I was really wrestling with this film, and it did eventually really win me over as I thought about it, I was thinking about, Dana, I know you listen to the WTF podcast with Marc Maron, and there's a expression he uses sometimes whenever he has on a guest who is usually a younger comedian and they're a little more absurd and abstract. He'll describe their comedy as being like math. It's like math, you know, it's 1 + 1 = 2. The joke, you take this element, you take this element, it equals funny. And there's this meticulous nature to it. It's very well crafted and precise. And it doesn't necessarily resonate with Mark, who's this comedian who's more raw and unhinged and just wants to kind of go on about his personal life. And I think that applies to this film, though. It's a little bit like math, with this film being advanced calculus. And on some level, I feel like people watching it, depending on where they fall on that Wes Anderson scale, they're either going to think it's the best Wes Anderson film ever, or the best since Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums, or they're going to find it the worst Wes Anderson film ever, because in some ways it's the apotheosis. It's the perfect formula. It's as if he has literally taken all those elements, and you referenced a few of them from the Slate article, but, you know, the dysfunctional families, the dialogue we talked about, the set design, the heightened use of color. You really saw it there in that clip. Yellow, Darjeeling Limited, he loves yellow, the suitcase, the weeds in the background, the field. It's really amazing. The pop soundtrack, Dana, as you touched on. The camera moves sometimes. He'll be very ostentatious with them. The tracking shots. The beginning of this film with Benjamin Britten is so precise. The camera quickly panning and these shots through the house. It's so meticulous that it actually did seem to me that if Wes Anderson took everything that defines his films and threw them into a computer, it would spit out this movie. And that makes it sound more clinical than I mean it to, because the fact is, even though that's true, for me, I'm with you, Josh, that there are enough moments in this film that all those equations ultimately add up to something human. I think he is ultimately trying to get at something human, which is that sense of community and this coming-of-age story. Finding these characters, it's interesting to note how many times in this film different people have different guides they reference, or they have different mentors who they're trying to aspire to be. You know,
right, the boating regulations.
Exactly.
Book and
everyone's
all that
got a book that they're looking to for some kind of guidance. Social Services, played by Tilda Swinton, you're going to follow the book. And even, of course, Ed Norton's character looks up to Harvey Keitel, reveres this figure. There's someone that they're looking to for some kind of guidance. And I think this is almost as if, just like the opening music, the Benjamin Britten, which shows you how a composer will take variations on a theme, this movie is variations on that theme of that coming of age story of people trying to find their way and figure out what guides work for them.
You mentioned the yellow color scheme, and I think there's some interesting visual stuff going on here too with the use of 16mm, and that gives it kind of this grainy, faded look for much of the film.
Isn't it like digital film that's treated to look like 16mm?
Is that what they did?
I think so.
I don't know. Whatever
it's definitely
they
a super
did,
16 look is what they're going for.
Yeah, it definitely looks of the period. But then that climactic scene, the one that I referenced, is interesting because all of a sudden we get this study in kind of deep blues and silhouettes. And it's become this, it's almost like something from the silent movie era when they would colorize.
Are you talking about when they're in the boat?
No, at the church, during the storm, and you kind of see their silhouettes at the, you know, where they end up going. And I just thought this was really striking, although there are a lot of repeated visual motifs from his other films. There are some chances and differences too that were pretty striking to me.
I just wonder, he's such an obsessive, and we kind of love that about him, but I also sort of wonder, I mean, this is about two kids who fall in love, who are also portrayed as being sort of borderline mentally ill, you know, and I think that Wes Anderson has that side. I think he has that side of an obsessive who's going deeper and deeper into himself, and I just don't know where there is to go from there.
No, that's a fair question, and, you know, I'm waiting for the Wes Anderson film that will feel like a repeat, like a continual burrowing without finding something else there. But I guess just so far, each one has either opened itself up to me and opened up other things he's done to me in a new way, or tried something a little bit new. So he's definitely so specific that I understand that concern. I can see what you're talking about.
And it's funny that Fantastic Mr. Fox, which has a lot of literal burrowing in it, it's a movie about burrowing, is, I think, one of his most outward directed and one of his best movies.
Yeah, you're right.
I just want to throw out there, too. I don't know. Again, it seems as a lot of people have seen this movie. Did everyone catch all of the cinematic references in this movie? I'd love to know if there's a website out there where someone has made note of this. There's one very blatant visual homage to The Shawshank Redemption. Actually, in this film, there's a moment where clearly he's trying to, with the young girl, recall Brigitte Bardot or something on the beach, and there's dialogue. Of course, one of the characters in the Boy Scout troop is named Redford. So there's no larger point. I just find it really fascinating. And one of the ones I found most fascinating is there was a line of dialogue at one point. I think it was Sam who says, no, actually, it may have been Susie, who says something like, you push a man so far, there's only so much before they break. And I'm like, that's out of a movie. No one would say that. And I Googled it today, and it's from the movie Max Payne. So
we'll never be referenced.
I don't know why Wes Anderson is
movie
watching Max
Moonrise
Payne,
Kingdom.
But I swear there's a blatant rip from Max Payne.
And you remembered
film.
It. That's the interesting thing.
It stands out, you know? What can I say? All right. Well, any final thoughts? Anybody have any closing remarks on Moonrise Kingdom?
I'm good.
I think okay. I'm done.
Well, Moonrise Kingdom is out now in limited release. We'd love to hear what you think about the film. Email feedback@filmspotting.net.
And Dana's also going to be back to join us for our top five, so look
yep.
forward to that.
Okay.
Guys, there are three simple rules that I live by. Never get less than 12 hours sleep. Never play cards with a guy who has the same first name as a city. And never get involved with a woman with a tattoo of a dagger on her body.
Stick to that. Everything else is cream cheese, Josh.
Those and other valuable life lessons we've learned from the movies and the Film Spotting Top 5 next. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Danny Boyle, sadly not here tonight at Lincoln Hall in Chicago, but we are here, Film Spotting, celebrating its 400th episode. Thank you so much for coming out, everybody. Great crowd. Great crowd and a great venue. I'm Adam Kempinar with Josh Larson and our very special guest host, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, Dana Stevens from Slate.com and Slate Culture Gabfest. I do want to plug real quick before we get to the top five. Lincoln Hall, they've got a movie night Wednesday, June 20th, starts at 7 p.m., and it's a free event. You can come see two great summer movies together, Dazed and Confused and Wet Hot American Summer. So that's a great double feature. Film Spotting endorses that double feature. Again, Lincoln Hall, 7 p.m. on Wednesday, June 20th. And that does bring us to the Film Spotting Top 5 this week. Top 5 things we learned from the movies. Probably the vaguest, most difficult, most introspective top 5 we've ever done. We'll see if it comes out with any kind of true introspection or not as we get through this list. But we're going to start with Dana. Before that, generally, Josh, you want to talk about how you tackled this list?
I looked for lessons that the movies kind of crystallized for me because of their own form of artistic identity. So it's something maybe I knew or, you know, or was aware of, but it wasn't until a certain movie kind of hit it home for me. So those are kind of the growing awareness things, but there are a few where they're like those epiphany moments too, where mm-hmm. you're like, ah, yeah. So
yeah, I think to be clear, though there may be some of them, these picks are probably not going to be things where there's a very clear moral being shared. It's not going to be something like Apocalypse Now, Never Get Out of the Boat, or even Ghostbusters, Don't Cross the Streams. We're probably not going to go for things like that, though you never know, we might. But I think what you're saying, Josh, is the way I approached it, too, kind of changes in perspective on something, or maybe it prompted actual changes in your behavior and how you viewed the world. And with my list in particular, I think actually I found as I was forming it that these are more picks that all affected me through the past 7 years or so that I've been doing film spotting. I don't really have anything from way before that anyway, kind of my formative years, if you will. These have been my formative movie years, I guess. So with that, Dana, launch us with your number five.
Okay. Well, first of all, Adam, I just want to curse you for making this our top five assignment because it was so difficult.
I cursed it all week myself.
Because this is a top five that forces you to go deep. It forces you to actually think about your own history with the movies, which is great, but it also made it a lot harder. So because I couldn't decide how seriously to take the assignment, I sort of decided to gradate from 5 to 1, the most shallow revelation to the nice. Deepest. So my number
what
five.
What happens if all of yours are shallow?
Yeah, that's for you all to judge, I guess. So my number five, this one is really embarrassing, but it's from Martha Coolidge's Valley Girl in 1983,
good
which
film.
Is
good film.
Maybe a movie that I've seen as much as any movie, as many times, just simply because it was from the early days of VCRs, at least my family's early days of VCRs. And there was a period when the only two VHS tapes we possessed were Valley Girl and Jaws. So
yeah.
I've seen
set.
Them both countless times.
Another
we were
double
set.
Feature film spotting endorses.
And so there's many lessons to be learned in Valley Girl, which if you haven't seen it, is a kind of Romeo and Juliet, a very explicitly Romeo and Juliet story between a boy from Hollywood and a girl from the Valley. It's also the breakthrough movie for Nicolas Cage, not his first movie, but his first big role. And he's really, really wonderful as this sort of punk in love. But so my lesson is just this scene where Julie, the main character, the Juliet character, is talking to her father, played by Frederick Forrest, who we know mainly from Apocalypse Now as the chef character, but he plays this wonderful hippie dad, this health food store manager who listens to his daughter's problems. And she sits down with him and asks for some fatherly advice. She says, "Dad, I need to ask you something." She's trying to decide between these two boys, Nicolas Cage and the kind of prom king that she's been going out with. And he says, he interrupts her without even asking what the question is and says, "Get the more expensive one, honey. The more expensive ones always fit better." And that's a piece of advice that's come very handy over the years. So that's my shallow insight number five.
I love it. Michael, you're number five.
My number five is it's purely personal, and I kind of twisted this little heinous little assignment, Adam and Josh, around the five senses. Okay, because I thought, what the hell? Let's pile one pointlessly. Let's put one concept on top of an existing concept. So there I was, 17 years old. I was a freshman at the University of Minnesota, and I'm taking ballroom dance, and as a one credit class for some reason. And I'm not having a very good time with it. And every time we had a question about a move with, like, you know, the Foxtrot or something, the TA, who was from Shanghai, didn't speak a word of English, would just come over and, unbelievably good ballroom dancer, and he would just whisk your partner away magically in a really stunning kind of 30, 40-second display of how to do it. And he would just simply return her and say, that's how you do it. And I thought, well, that didn't help. And then I saw a film called Roberta, which was not in circulation widely at the time. This is 1978, I think. It was an Astaire Rogers film, and not my first, but because that was a rare film that wasn't in television circulation much then. And then I saw this one number called in that film called "I'll Be Hard to Handle," which remains probably one of my two or three favorite solo duets they ever did on screen. And so, built around my little five senses thing, this was the one that explained touch to me, and sort of the virtue of learning really how to do ballroom dance, because it's a great excuse. It's the way to be able to actually get hands on a woman you don't know very well yet.
Wow. Good stuff.
My number five comes from Back to the Future. And the lesson is that the world existed before me, which should seem obvious, but isn't always so obvious. When Michael J. Fox's Marty McFly finds himself in 1955, it isn't the science that blows his mind as much as the fact that he's facing the living, breathing reality that his parents were once teenagers. I saw this probably when I was 10 or 11, but it still opened up my own time-space continuum in kind of similar ways. I knew my parents and my grandparents, teachers, other adults had passed. You know, you hear stories, you see photographs, but it wasn't really till I saw Back to the Future kind of live it out that it hit home, and I really realized that. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't until I had kids, actually, where the time-space continuum thing was kind of exploded in a similar way, and I realized what Back to the Future had done, because suddenly with kids, time opened up ahead of me, like through their lives, beyond mine, and it was very similar to the way Back to the Future kind of opened up the past behind me to other people's lives. So it hit me pretty hard for a pretty silly science fiction film.
Biff, leave him alone! Let him go! Let him go!
Are you okay?
Obviously a crowd favorite here, and justifiably so. Back to the Future is a great film, great pick. My number five, I'll be the one that goes a little dark and a little bit cynical here with my number five. Hopefully I'll lighten up as we go through it. I'll actually start with a quote from the movie that kind of sums it up. We'll test our crowd, see if anyone can actually name the movie I'm quoting. Will I lie to myself to be happy? It is Memento. Well done. Well done. It's from the end of Memento, and my answer to that question is yes, you probably will lie to yourself to be happy. And that's a film for me that I really remember that moment where that revelation happens. And I'm not going to get into the details of it too much for those who maybe haven't seen Memento, but the fact is you get to the end of that film and you have a character who the whole movie has been on a single mission, and you really think that when he gets to the end and he finds out some key information that really changes everything about the mission he's on, that although it makes his life harder, you think he would embrace that information because he's discovering the truth. He's closer to discovering the truth, even if on some level he's actually getting further away because it's getting tougher. And he has a moment where he gets to decide whether or not he's going to accept that truth and move on from there, or just accept his truth and keep going on his mission and keep his life simple and happy and give himself a purpose. And he chooses that. And that just knocked me out when I saw that, and actually changed a little bit how I viewed the world and people, though I don't think it describes. I think you can generalize that there's something to say there about the human condition. It doesn't describe all of us, but that really did form me when I saw it for the first time. I think it's come up in other films, too, that I was prepared for because of Memento. I think about, I didn't plan on quoting from an M. Night Shyamalan film tonight, but a movie like Unbreakable, the end of Unbreakable, Samuel L. Jackson says, you know what the scariest thing is? To not know your place in this world, to not know why you're here. And I also was thinking about with this pick here, my number five, the great Kurosawa film Rashomon, where you really learn that truth is completely subjective, and in the end, you will probably choose whatever helps you get through the day. You'll choose the truth that keeps you happy. So that's my dark, cynical number five pick. Dana, you're number four. Please lighten the mood.
Well, Rashomon, going deep here. Yeah, I was finding making this list that it was sort of hard to choose great movies for it, because most truly great movies like Rashomon are about so much more than one thing. They have so much more than one lesson or one message. Okay, so my number four is The Vanishing, the Dutch The Vanishing from 1988. You guys know this movie? I think it's one of the scariest movies I've ever seen.
Talk about lightening the mood, man.
So I think the principal lesson we can take away from The Vanishing is that when someone admits to you that he kidnapped your girlfriend and she's been missing for years, you probably don't drink the cup of coffee that he hands you.
You don't need that truth.
Let me write
it.
That one down.
but I think in a larger way, the message of The Vanishing, which I think is a great, great movie, really a great, an incredibly suspenseful, intense horror movie, but also just a really thoughtful and beautiful film about love and about obsession and about a lot of the things that Vertigo is about, in fact, about not being able to let go of the past, not being able to let go of a past love, not being able to move on. I think maybe the main lesson that I would take away from it is let it go. Let the past be the past. And I think the movie is a really harsh parable about what happens when people are unable to move on.
Wow, this is going to come back in this pick, in fact. I think, Dana, this is going to have some nice symmetry here. But, Michael, you're number four.
My number four, sticking to my pointless five senses sub-theme.
You know, I'm all about rules and conceits. I love
know.
It, Michael.
Just the sense of smell. And it's also just a way of horning in one of my favorite movies, Sweet Smell of Success from 1957. And if you can, it's a film where you can actually almost, you can really get a whiff of the perspiration coming off Tony Curtis's forehead, you know, the whole time, because this character is in a sweat the entire time, I guess I love that film just because it is so it's so truly pungent in every crazy line of dialogue that Clifford Odets, especially among the contributors, wrote. And is it a film that, you know, teaches the enemy life lessons? I guess other than just you do everything you can to survive until the thing you can't do, and it's always good to know where you have to draw the line, even if it costs you everything. So that's my little number four.
All right, very nice. My number four, I'm going to go with Toy Story 3, and the lesson is two words.
That was also written by Clifford Odets.
Was it? Yes. I did not know that. Here's a lesson from Toy Story 3, at least the one I took. Grow up. And I think we have a clip. We'll take a look at that first, and I'll explain a little bit. All right, it's okay. I see you crying out there. I think I cried at that one. I'm talking a lot about movies that make me cry, and I never cry at movies, so I don't know what's going on.
You strike me as the kind of guy who cries at card tricks.
That's next. I'm going to go the opposite way for Toy Story 3, because a lot of times we see that scene and we think about how the movie, and rightly so, is praised for evoking nostalgia. It authentically celebrates nostalgia, something that's often falsely celebrated. But one thing I took from this finale when Andy leaves his toys there is that at some point we do have to move on. And I think this is especially true for kind of our fanboy age and those in their 30s and 40s who have had their childhoods kind of packaged as pop cultural artifacts. And there's some fun in that, but there's also some danger in that you can have a generational myopia where you get stuck in that's all you want to see. That's all that has value. And so it's okay to an extent. Personally, I think I would have hung on to Woody in that scene and let her have the rest of them. But we can't let it turn into this thing where we miss out on the great pop art that's coming, and also the stuff that's, you know, way before, too, and kind of get stuck in our own era.
Toy Story 3, obviously a fantastic choice. Actually, I'll admit this is the one pick that Josh and I coordinated a little bit, or I forced him to coordinate with me a little bit, because it's my number four as well, but actually kind of going in a little bit of a different direction, whereas Josh likes to focus on the end of that scene and that moment where Andy finally puts away the toys and drives off. I choose to focus on the previous 2 or 3 minutes in that montage where we see him actually sit down one last time and play with those toys. And that really is a magical moment. So I'd say maybe you can say goodbye to your past, but maybe you don't have to do it forever. And to illustrate that, or why this movie hit me on such a gut level, actually, I mentioned this on the show back when we reviewed it, but at the end of the discussion, I happened to, just trying to be funny, had to insult my mother for throwing away my Millennium Falcon when I was a kid. Because I saw that scene, I just wanted to get out the Millennium Falcon and play with my toys again, and I don't have it, and I'm not bitter or anything. But one film spotting listener, this is how great you all are, was moved enough by that conversation that about a week later, I got a Millennium Falcon in the mail.
Oh.
Like the exact same Millennium Falcon. The original thing in the original box.
And the listener was George Lucas, so it was actually like to scale. It was to scale.
Yes, it was.
Andy charged you. There was a bill.
Ouch. So the lesson that I took away from that actually was that you have to allow yourself to get lost in your imagination, or it's okay to be a kid sometimes. That's what I took away from that moment, because I really watched that and found myself lamenting the fact that it's so easy to get caught up in your serious everyday life and thinking about all the more important things you have to do. And I never allow myself those moments to sit down. Even with my kids, I don't allow myself enough to sit down and really embrace those kind of goofy moments where you just get lost in your imagination for a while. And that movie made me really reflect on that. I actually want to share an email from another film spotting listener, Eric, who was in Racine, probably still in Racine, Wisconsin. He wrote at the time, "I haven't seen the film yet, but I'll be lining up, because as a parent of three boys, I too find one of my great struggles in life is finding a way to help my kids grow and mature without losing their ability to tap in what is core to our humanity. I fear that I have lost it. Adam, it sounds like you're grieving it. Hopefully this film will act as a spotlight on a great evil which has largely gone unnoticed in our society. A spotlight that will stir hearts and call us to action. That's what I love about Pixar. Even the movies they make that are most flawed focus on the great questions of purpose in our modern lives." So obviously Toy Story 3 was one where Josh is reading the scene absolutely dead on, and yet I can't help but really reflect on and react to that amazing moment where he does sit down one last time and play with those toys. And it does actually come back to me every now and again. And I brought this up again when we talked about The Tree of Life. When I think about that Terrence Malick film and those amazing moments where we see the montage of the family playing in the front yard and the gorgeous cinematography and just that the idyllic nature of those shots, it made me sit down and think, you know what, I don't spend enough time just being out in my backyard acting like an idiot with my kids, and I need to do that more.
Well, that's what the movies can do best, I think, is really just make us feel lousy about our own lives.
Those are all the most valuable life lessons, Michael. It's time you learn them. So that's my number four, Toy Story 3 as well. Josh, you're listening to Film Spotting. We are celebrating our 400th episode with a very dour top five, the top five things we learn from watching the movies, and it's time for Dana Stevens to make her number three pick.
Yes, I'm excited about my number three because it's the one where I get to show my clip. So my my number three is from George Cukor's Gaslight from 1944, which is one of my favorite movies of all time and was a very key kind of formative text for me when I first saw it. I guess I first saw it in my 20s or so, and I just remember it resonating with me so profoundly, this story of a woman played by Ingrid Bergman whose husband, Charles Boyer, is trying to make her think she's crazy. For a variety of reasons, he's trying to cover up his own past crimes, and they live in this mysterious London townhouse that has a mysterious attic that contains his secrets. And the whole movie is about him kind of filching things and pretending that she lost them, lowering the gas lights so that she thinks that she's going crazy, and this is, no, the light's been exactly the same. And slowly, little by little, he gets her to this point where she doesn't know whether she is crazy or not. So the scene that I want to show is where, for various reasons that I won't reveal, she turns the tables on him. It's toward the end of the movie. He's now up in the attic where the secrets that will reveal the truth are contained. He's tied to a chair, and she's kind of playing cat and mouse with him in this fabulous way. Let's watch it.
My brooch. The brooch I lost at the tower. I found it at last, you see, but it doesn't help you, does it? And I'm trying to help you, aren't I? Trying to help you to escape. How can a mad woman help her husband to escape?
But you're not mad.
Yes, I am mad, as my mother was mad.
No, Paula, that wasn't true. Help me.
If I were not mad, I could have helped you. Whatever you had done, I could have pitied and protected you. But because I am mad, I hate you. Because I am mad, I have betrayed you. And because I am mad, I'm rejoicing in my heart without a shred of pity, without a shred of regret, watching you go with glory in my heart.
It's so righteous, right? I just love that scene. And you have to know that it comes after this whole movie where Ingrid Bergman is just this kind of tense, you know, just constantly frightened, constantly on edge, and constantly being manipulated by Charles Boyer. So it's just such a fantastic moment when she turns it around. And I guess the lesson would be, I guess the reason that I love this movie so much has to do with just trusting yourself, right? I mean, the lesson that she learns at the end is, wait a minute, I wasn't just paranoid, I wasn't just crazy. All of my worst fears were true all along. So I don't want to say the lesson is all of your worst fears are true all along, but just that, particularly in personal relationships, right? In a marriage or a close friendship, you can't let somebody else control your mind. You have to trust your own instincts. And I love that moment at the end. She won an Oscar for that role, incidentally, and I think you can really see why in that scene.
I am ashamed to admit that right after your last appearance on the show, we talked about Take Shelter, and I think we did our top five movies about insanity.
Gaslight was one of my movies,
right? And Gaslight
was
one of your picks, and I said, oh, I'm adding that to my queue right away, and I did, and I still haven't had a chance to watch it. But after seeing that scene and hearing you talk about it, I obviously am really
Gaslight is
eager
just
to
such
see
a pleasure to watch. It's I feel like melodrama is kind of underrepresented in our conversations about movies these days. Mm-hmm. Melodrama has sort of disappeared. Melodramas are sort of terrible now, right? Hollywood sappy melodramas are just not what they used to be, and George Cukor could really make a melodrama.
Michael, you're number three.
My number three of my five senses pick is of sound, and I love a film from right around the same time, 1940. It's one of my favorites, His Girl Friday, and that's a film that it's got everything I love hearing in a movie. You know, machine guns occasionally, but mainly it has the sound of the fastest dialogue I think ever recorded. You know, certainly they basically did with major revisions because they changed the gender of Hildy Johnson so Roz Russell could play her. They basically did a 3-hour play. Howard Hawks and Ben Hecht and the other writers did the 3-hour play in 88 minutes. And Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell in that film, I think, are spitting the fastest and some of the sharpest dialogue ever, and it's my favorite romantic comedy couple since Beatrice and Benedict and Much Ado About Nothing, several centuries earlier. And I just, I love the sound of that movie. It's a film that Howard Hawks, you know, gave it incredible propulsion and filmed it sort of, it's the best kind of self-effacing technique that just completely serves the material. And I love the way that movie sounds.
Did you have that as we talked on the show earlier about top five telephone scenes? Was that your pick?
Yeah, because
the telephones are another sound in there.
Oh, God, this is an incredible, one of my favorite shots in the movie is a simple five-second transition where every phone in the city press room in Chicago is ringing, and it's the old hook and whatever phones. I forget what you call them, but you know the two piece with the earpiece and everything. And it's just like every ring in a slightly different key, and it's like just the most magical sound in the world. It's gone, you know. It's a sound nobody knows what it sounds like anymore, and just like nobody knows what a manual typewriter sounds like anymore. And luckily, I'm old enough, just old enough. You mentioned 30s and 40s, which I resent. I resent that age group because I'm 51. I was born.
I thought I had you covered.
No,
sorry.
No. In the Chinese zodiac, I was born in the year of the colonoscopy. So that.
get a rim shot.
Yeah. Thank you. But you know.
Nobody there.
All right. But that's another great, great sort of part of the symphony of the way that movie sounds and breathes. I love it.
All right, I'd love to be able to lighten things up considerably with number three, but unfortunately, my film is Alhazard Balthazar. So,
sure.
The lesson, conduct
be nice to donkeys?
Yes, let's go on. Number two. No. Conduct yourself as if someone's watching, I guess, basically is kind of one of the things you can draw from, as you said, a very multi-layered film, as masterpieces are. We talked about it, Adam and I did, with our Robert Bresson marathon. And one of the things I talked about is how this 1966 film, it adopts the gaze of innocence, really, as we see the world through the eyes of the title donkey who changes hands in this village. So Balthazar sees humanity, you know, at its best and at its worst. He is beaten and also adorned with flowers in other scenes. And often he's watching people as they're doing something wrong, and they're doing it because they think no one's watching. But of course, Balthazar is. And I just think it's a really poetic stand-in for the concept of conscience, and the fact that you're going to be at your best if you understand that someone is watching you, even if that someone is innocent. So be careful, someone's watching.
Well, I will lighten things up a little bit. Finally, with my number three pick here, as we share our top five things we learned from the movies. And mine is, I'll sum it up as, I want to be John Wayne, but I'm not even Jimmy Stewart. And obviously my reference point there is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But, you know, my question, who wouldn't want to be the strong, silent type? Let all your actions do the talking. You know, whether it's John Wayne is Tom Donovan in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, or Sheriff John T. Chance in Rio Bravo, or basically John Wayne in every film ever made. Alan Ladd as Shane obviously comes to mind as well. I want to be the guy who's always in control, who never backs down from any challenge, and always acts with integrity. And he's never selfish. He just always seems to do the right thing. That's the ideal, I think, that the movies give us to strive for, at least a masculine ideal. And the fact is, though, when I think about it, I wouldn't even be Jimmy Stewart. If Lee Marvin came to town, Liberty Valance showed up and was giving me grief, I'd just leave town just right away, you know, 5 minutes. I'd have my bags packed. And actually, another movie, I will go back to my childhood a little bit that ties in with this, is Sam Shepard is just one of those guys who you want to talk about what you think a man is. Sam Shepard is that guy, and he plays Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff, which is a movie I just watched a million times when I was a kid. And I love that he's this pilot, he's a test pilot, and they, of course, want him to be part of the Mercury mission because he's the most famous pilot in the world, and he has just absolutely no interest in being famous or having a lot of money or getting any adulation. He just wants to be the guy who does his job and does it well, and he wants to be a test pilot and be the best at it. And there's that great scene where he finally just goes off with no fanfare whatsoever and tries to break the sound barrier. And that's another one of those characters that just is that kind of masculine ideal that the movies give us to strive for, that of course we don't match, but that's maybe one of the reasons that I like the movie so much, is they give us that chance to embrace that ideal. So I'm still shooting for it. I'm clearly not there. I'm clearly not there, but
someday, Adam, someday.
Someday. I can keep trying. I'll take lessons from Michael and take ballroom dancing. I think
I don't think that's going to help.
No? Yeah, right. No? Okay. Yeah. Well, we're having fun here with our top five. We are going to take a quick break, though. We'll come back with the top two things the movies taught us. Stay with us.
See, you made friends with them. See, friendship is the booze they feed you. As they want you to get drunk and feeling like you belong.
Well, it was fun.
Because they make you feel cool. And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't.
How about that? Let's hear it for Lester Bangs and the advice from Almost Famous. Welcome back to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar with Josh Larson and our very special guest, Dana Stevens from Slate, and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. We are sharing our top five lessons we learned from the movies, and that's a tough one to learn. An honorable mention for me that I'm uncool, but this movie helped reinforce that, and of course that great final lesson there from Lester Bangs I think is worth taking to heart. We're going to get to our top two picks here in the top five in a second, but first we do want to announce the winner of our giveaway prize. We're really excited about this because we developed a little partnership here with a local company, Lomo Kino. They have this great, great product where they're trying to bring analog back to the movies. And it's a movie camera that shoots short creative movies on 35mm film. So seems like something a Film Spotting crowd might actually want to take home. So we want to thank Lomography for being here tonight and allowing us to give one away to a Film Spotting listener in attendance. So you were all given a number as you walked in. I have the number. I also have some backups. I'm going to announce the number, and all you have to do is go out during the break and claim your prize at the table there, the merch table, where we are also selling T-shirts, I might add, for just $10. So there's a little plug for that. The winner of the Lomo Kino camera is, and I'm very jealous about this because I'm not getting one, number 51. Can we see a hand here? Who's number 51? All right. Congratulations. Yay. Very exciting. So, again, right out there at the table there with the merch as you came in, you can get your prize here after the show. That brings us back to our top five countdown. What's the number two lesson you learned from the movies, Dana?
It's I'm the first one on every one, right? The pressure's on. Okay, so my number two lesson is from my cinematic patron saint, I would say, Buster Keaton. And the movie that I chose is, this is really true of any Buster Keaton movie. I think you can take this lesson away. But the movie that I chose is this short of his. It's a 1920 short directed by Buster Keaton called 1 Week. I don't know if y'all know this. It's like on most of the collections of his shorts. And you can also watch the whole thing on YouTube in a pretty decent copy. And I highly recommend it. It's really wonderful. The lesson is basically just never give up, keep on trying no matter how chaotic and how insane everything around you becomes. So 1 Week is the story of Buster Keaton and his bride. It's a young couple who upon their marriage get a gift of a house kit. I think these actually existed in the 20s, right? You could construct your own house from a kit. So they have all these crates of lumber. But then a villain sneaks in, a jealous suitor who wanted to marry Buster's bride, and he switches the boxes, the numbers on the boxes around. So when they build the house, it comes out completely cockamamie. It looks like the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's all crazy angles. The front door is on the second floor, so when you walk out the door, you fall down a whole story. And then the rest of the 20-minute two-reeler is just this couple's attempt, no matter what, to keep putting this house back together. A tornado tears it apart. A train drives into it. It just becomes this pile of shards of lumber, and they're still trying to figure out some way to make it a house they can live in and love each other. And it's just, to me, is this wonderful allegory of marriage and of just life, of just coping with the chaos of daily existence. I love 1 Week.
Yeah, it's a fantastic film. Michael, you're number two.
God, is he not the greatest American film artist? I think.
Might be.
You know, he really is amazing.
He really is. He's one of the great artists we produced in any medium, I think.
Yeah. My number two is, and my senses tick down here, is taste. What I got from the Orson Welles film, The Magnificent Ambersons, which is a film I come back to a lot, and it's is a really profound sort of sense of yearning for a past that wasn't really like you're watching it in the film. It's a film that's steeped in this nostalgia that you can't really trust. And Wells's story of this kind of grand family in what is, I think, a disguised version of Indianapolis, Booth Tarkington's, I think that was his hometown, wasn't it? Indianapolis. There are images in this film that are, I'm thinking of the Amberson ball sequence. Do people know this film at all? It's horribly mutilated after the midpoint. It's an 80. I mean, it was well shot a much longer version and then went off to South America. And, they tested poorly, so they cut a hell of a lot out of it and reshot some. And different people came in including Robert Wise. And the film's really only great in the first half, but in the Amberson ball sequence, it ends with a shot of people saying goodnight and kind of an assignation being arranged for at least a sleigh ride for the next day. And it's just three figures in silhouette in Stanley Cortez's black and white sort of shadow universe. The cinematography is amazing. And it's the first image I ever saw in any film where I thought, that's so beautiful, I can actually taste it. And then the whole flavor of that film is all about this sort of like this become this sort of bittersweet nostalgia. It's like it doesn't last, and yet that film, mutilated as it is, you know, and sad in many ways, just because it is not the complete film, it does last. And that's my metaphoric answer to taste.
Top five films you can taste. I think we got to get to that one.
I think at
concept.
Some point we need to do it. But just this past weekend on Twitter, I think some of the Pixar guys like Brad Bird and Andrew Stanton, and I'm sure other people got involved, were doing their kind of movie dream scenario. I can't remember exactly what the hashtag is. Did anyone else see this? Do you remember the hashtag? It was something much more pithy than I just said. But one of them was, you know, The Magnificent Ambersons is released to great acclaim, and Orson Welles goes on making every film he wants to make for the rest of his lives. And in movie dream world, basically, that would have happened. Unfortunately, yeah, it did not. Josh, you're number two.
I wanted to avoid direct quotes for this list, but I couldn't in the case of this film, and especially in the light of talking Moonrise Kingdom. It's from Rushmore. Find something you love and do it for the rest of your life. That's the answer that Jason Schwartzman's Max Fisher gives to Bill Murray's Herman Bloom when he's asked, what's the secret, Max? And it's so true, but it's also so hard to follow, I think, especially when the question of vocation comes into play, because we can, you know, feel like, well, do for what we love for the rest of our life. Well, that's got to be our job. And, it's so infrequently works out that way. I think one interesting thing that's developed, one of the benefits of the explosion of movie blogs has made this possible for a lot of people, really, who love movies like we do, like a lot of the listeners do, and now can do it for the rest of their lives, you know, and get a readership. So it's just one way you can kind of cross that borderline. And also in Anderson's style, I love how the quote is undercut. You know, it's kind of this, not emotional moment, but it's this epiphany moment that seems on the nose, but then it's undercut when Max says, for me, that's going to Rushmore, as if, you know, he could go to Rushmore for the rest of his life. That's really what he wants to do.
Hey, it's Max Fisher.
Oh, hi.
Hey, Max, my mom just showed up. Is it okay if I leave early? Over.
Sure, Charlie.
What's the secret, Max?
The secret?
Yeah, well, you seem to have it pretty figured out.
Secret, I don't know. I think you just gotta find something you love to do and then do it for the rest of your life. For me, it's going to Rushmore.
Shotgun.
Hey, Ronnie. Hey, Danny. Hey, guys.
In the back, I said shotgun.
In the back, Donnie.
My number two pick actually goes back to my number three, where I was lamenting my lack of masculinity, basically, and how I wanted to be John Wayne, but am not even Jimmy Stewart. And the fact is, as I look at my number two and the movie that inspired it, it's a movie I loved from last year, Take Shelter. And what that movie did was kind of make me rethink my number three choice and realize that that masculine ideal really is just a myth. And Dan, I like what you were saying about marriages and a good relationship and what it requires. And that's what I really took away from Take Shelter. I think that movie is as much about a marriage and a lack of communication and a lack of intimacy as it is anything else. And there's a key scene in particular, I can't remember if we talked about it during our discussion or not, Dana, where the main character is having visions and nightmares and is clearly kind of going through a really rough period. And he wakes up at one point and he finds that he's wet the bed, and his wife comes in and says it's time to go to church or whatever, and he, of course, recoils and says, stay away. And he's way too embarrassed to, as you can imagine, he's way too embarrassed to have his wife come and see that he's done that to their bed. And it makes me think that, you know, maybe Michael Shannon's character in that film spent too much time watching John Wayne movies and couldn't allow himself in that moment to actually be vulnerable and actually be weak in front of the person that loves him. And I think that it's crucial for a relationship to work, to actually be in a position where you can allow yourself to be at your absolute worst, be at your lowest, and really be embarrassing and vulnerable and weak. And that scene really hit home that moment for me. So Take Shelter is my number two pick as we share our top five things we learned from the movies, and we are at the big moment, our number one. Dana.
I just have to note that there can't be a film spotting anymore without Take Shelter or what's the director's name again? I'm blanking now.
Jeff Nichols.
Jeff Nichols has become one of the new...
He's our patron saint.
Yeah, completely. He's in the pantheon, and absolutely, he belongs there. All right, so my number one... Actually, I'm going to go with the lesson first on number one, because I couldn't decide which movie to plug in. There are many movies, I feel, that sort of offer this lesson and keep offering it, and many of them are my favorite movies. And the lesson is to slow down and pay attention, basically, to really look at what you're watching. And not only to slow down and pay attention to the movie, but the kind of movie that makes you slow down and pay attention to everything when you walk outside the theater, right? That's what's really rare. So I was trying to think of different movies that have done that, and I know Kiarostami is one director who can do that for me, especially the movie Close Up that you guys talked about recently on this show. Godard at his best can sometimes do that for me. But one director who almost always does that, who really makes me look closely on the way out of the theater as well, is Ozu, Yasujiro Ozu, the Japanese director. So the movie of his that I chose for this lesson was I Was Born But, which is one of his silent movies. Ozu had this huge career. It spanned, I don't know, 50 or 60 years. He started off in silent movies, and he continued to make movies into the early 60s, I think. But this movie's from 1932, and it's silent, although it's so beautifully scripted and sort of structured that you forget that it's silent. I always think of it as a sound movie and imagine that I can hear the characters' voices, but it is a silent film about two boys, brothers, little children who live on the outskirts of Tokyo. And a lot of the movie is just about their daily life, about them playing hooky from school and avoiding the bullies in their neighborhood that chase them, and sort of getting used to this new environment because they've moved to this place on the outskirts of Tokyo with their family. And then very late in the movie, another story develops that has to do with their father and how he himself is sort of being bullied at work by his boss. But and it's a beautiful little sort of family drama at the end. But really, to me, it's just a movie about the quiet daily attention to daily life. And so that's my number one.
Wow. That's a great lesson, obviously, and Ozu, a great filmmaker who's been talked about a little bit on Film Spotting. At least Tokyo Story was a marathon film we did, but not a marathon about Ozu. I think that's a filmmaker who's probably ripe for some deep probing and some good in-depth discussion. So, great pick. Thank you, Dana. Michael, you're number one.
Yeah, mine, even though I actually consider Keaton a greater artist than Chaplin, my number one comes from the last minute of Chaplin's City Lights, and it sort of hits my sight, you know, senses, subject in that.
You need to be more excited about it. I like your approach.
I'm just trying to. It's hell to try to describe this without a clip because it's completely cinematic and it sort of defies any verbal. It's the simplest thing in the world in that the tramp is, you know, meets again the girl he's helped out who was blind formerly, but then gets the money for the operation. And when she sees him and he sees her on the street at the end, and he, you know, she realizes after touching his hand that, okay, this is the tramp. I thought he was somebody else. I thought he was a grander, you know, a different person altogether. And there's just a wonderful series of kind of, the only thing it said is, oh, you can see now, question. And she says, yes, I can see now. And then the close-up, and it's written about a million times, but the close-up you get of Chaplin at the end of that, and that ends. It's the most complex reaction shot in the history of cinema. In that, you're watching someone's heart in a state that doesn't know whether it's supposed to break or sort of burst with joy. It's both, and it's just one of the most complex chords I've ever heard in a silent film at the end of a thing. And it's all about kind of what we see and what we think we see, and really it goes to your pick, Dana, just about slow down, you know, kind of regard what you have in front of you and appreciate it, you know. Lovely.
Chaplin was actually one of my honorable mentions for Modern Times, but and another honorable mention actually, Dana, was your pick, I Was Born But, for a similar reason why I chose my number one, which is the lesson, don't watch things lightly, a little bit of where you were going. The film, however, is Rear Window. And one reason that Alfred Hitchcock's 1954 thriller, which she knows about the confined photographer who's watching his apartment neighbors and thinks he witnesses a murder, thinks there's a murder afoot, One of the reasons it's my current pick for best movie of all time is because it does work, again, on so many levels. It's a thriller, of course, but it's also about the voyeuristic nature of movie watching itself. And in a lot of ways, it kind of operates, and I think this is why it's one of my foundational films, as a call to criticism. It tells you watching has consequences because everything you watch has meaning. And, you know, everything you watch, even if, you know, the movies may not intend it, there's some meaning there. So think carefully about what you're watching, and always be aware when it comes to something as volatile as art, you're on dangerous ground.
You didn't want to recall Vertigo and have me do my Jimmy Stewart instead?
We've had enough of that.
Had enough? Okay. My number one, I think we got to go to the clip. I don't need to say anything about it. I will, of course, babble about it, but let's play it.
Why do you want to know, Doc? You don't have to report this, do you? It's regulations. Well, she didn't mean it. Doc, it was an accident. She had a little too much to drink. She didn't know what she was doing. There was no suicide note or anything. Believe me, Doc, I'm not thinking about myself.
Aren't you?
It's just, she's got a family, and there's the people at the office. Look, Doc, can't you forget you're a doctor? Let's just say you're here as a neighbor.
Well, as a doctor, I guess I can prove it wasn't an accident. But as your neighbor, I'd like to kick your keys to clear around the block. Mind if I cool this off?
Yeah, help yourself.
I don't know what you did to that girl in there, and don't tell me. But it was bound to happen the way you carry on. Live now, pay later. Diners Club. Why don't you grow up, Baxter? Be a mensch. You know what that means?
I'm not sure.
A mensch, a human being. So you got off easy this time. So you were lucky.
Wasn't I?
But you're not out of the woods yet, Baxter, because most of them try it again.
So, of course, the apartment, Billy Wilder, Jack Lemmon in that scene. This is the point in the show where everyone in the crowd in unison is supposed to chide me for picking a Pantheon film for my number one. It's supposed to be exempt, but the fact is, this is our 400th show. We can do whatever we want. And I'm going with The Apartment, and I'm going with that lesson of be a mensch. And first of all, just on a cinematic level, on an artistic level, that scene was important for me because it made me kind of rethink how I view a little bit what the difference is between comedy and drama, comedy and tragedy, which I think is on some level that a comedy is when you have a protagonist like C.C. Baxter in this film who realizes that he needs to be a mensch, that he needs to be a human being, and actually has time to adjust, has time to make a change and rethink his life and become a better human being. A tragedy is when you have that realization and it's too late. Whether you die or it's just a matter of you've made too many wrong decisions that they can't be overcome. And that was important, but also I just think that lesson, as simple and obvious as it should be, is one that really stuck out for me. I think because it's easy to watch The Apartment, especially the first time I saw it, and think of C.C. Baxter as a victim. The doctor is being kind of hard on him there. I mean, he's there to help Shirley MacLaine, who he has a crush on, and she's tried to commit suicide in the scene for people who may not be familiar with The Apartment. And the doctor is chiding him as if he's the one who's responsible when it's really the man in her life, the Fred McMurray character that she's so distraught over. But as you watch the film and as you really take that scene in about being a mensch and the lesson from the doctor, you realize that C.C. Baxter is really not that much better than those people. Maybe he's a little bit better, but the fact is he's enabled them by letting them use his apartment, and he has allowed Mrs. Kubelik to be abused in a certain way, and he really hasn't done anything to step up and actually help her. And moreover, he's done it because he wants a better office. He wants a better job. He basically did it because of his own ambition, and the outcome of that, whether he was directly responsible or not, was a woman that he loves trying to commit suicide. And so that was interesting for me, too, to really come at it from that perspective and realize that it's very easy for myself, or I think any of us here, to probably look at that C.C. Baxter character and see ourselves in him and think, okay, are we really doing what we can every day to be a mensch, to really be a human being and try to help other people or at least not bring more harm on other people? So that's my deep lesson from The Apartment.
Well, that's good.
An amazing film that obviously I think deserves to be in the Film Spotting Pantheon. That's why we put it there. So that is the Film Spotting Top 5. Any comments? Any closing remarks anyone want to make? Any honorable mentions that were tough to...
I mean, the other two that you already mentioned one, but the other way you can look at life, movies, the planet, our existence, everything is really just two films. It's the one you mentioned, you know, Frederick Forrest and Apocalypse Now, Never Get Out of the Boat. But how do you resolve that with... the lesson Robert Shaw's character Quint learns in Jaws, which is never get into the boat. So what are you supposed to do? You just don't go near boats? Or I don't know.
That's it.
There it is.
Well, I don't know if this is the right question to ask after that pick, but was anyone edified from this top five? Anybody learn anything from this top five?
Did you? Yeah.
Okay. I'll take it. Those are the top five things we've learned from the movies. You can send us your picks or just tell us what you thought of our list by emailing feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting or at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
And appropriately, as we think about what we learned, this is the part of the show where we ask what we learned from this episode. We talked about Prometheus, and we learned that we're
going to
have a fight about
book.
This at some point, a bigger fight
yeah,
about
this
Prometheus.
Isn't done.
This is bonus content at some point, I think. Over that film. We also talked about Moonrise Kingdom. I think we're all in a similar place on that film, even though Josh really moved by what Wes Anderson was doing. Maybe more so than us, Dana.
Yeah, I think I'm going to probably be at the least moved by it, and while appreciating it.
And we successfully edified our audience for the top five, so mission accomplished there. Out in wide release this weekend, Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, and of course Prometheus. And if you are curious about Dana's thoughts on Prometheus, I'm really excited to be able to tease this. Actually, I'm going to be appearing with Dana on Slate Spoiler Specials. We're going to talk in depth about Prometheus and really get into all of the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, we're going to have a no-holds-barred spoiler-full conversation about it, which you can find on Slate starting end of the week, right?
Yeah, seek that out. That will be a lot of fun. Of course, we'll link to it on Twitter and Facebook and on our website as well. Out in limited release this week is Els. This is the French/Polish film starring Juliette Binoche. It's got that going for it, and it's NC-17. Also, Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding. This is a film that's available on demand as well. Bruce Beresford directed that. Josh's favorite up-and-coming actress, Elizabeth Olsen. Jeffrey Dean Morgan is in it, and Jane Fonda, and Catherine Keener. It says Catherine Keener. Are you sure it's not Sandra Bullock?
Is there any difference, really?
There's really no difference.
No,
they're kind of the same.
Oh, there's a difference? What the hell are you saying?
Yeah. Well, next week on the show, right now, we're planning our Mark Duplass double feature because he's got two movies opening, Safety Not Guaranteed. We referenced that film earlier, and also Your Sister's Sister. This is the new film from Lynn Shelton, who directed what Mark Duplass film, everybody?
Hump Day.
That's right. One of my favorites here on the show, of course. So we're going to talk about both those movies. And instead of preparing for this show, I was doing interviews with the directors of both of those movies. I actually got a chance to talk with Lynn Shelton. And we're going to play that interview and also play my interview with the director of Safety Not Guaranteed, Colin Trevorrow. So look forward to that next week on the show. And, of course, our top five crackpots.
So wait a minute. We do this live show, and now next week we're going to have two reviews and two interviews.
Yeah.
You're a madman.
Well, I'm thinking we just play the interviews and we don't do anything.
Oh, okay. That I like.
I would love to do that, and I'll talk to you about that later. It is time for thank yous here on the show. And first, we have to start, I think, with two thank yous to people who are not present but here in spirit. Candace Griffiths, our associate producer, has been helping out with the show for at least 5 years, I think. Really couldn't do the show without her. She's all the way in Brisbane, Australia. Could not be here tonight. And, of course, the immortal Maddie Ballgame. Let's hear it for Maddie, who did 200 shows of Film Spotting and was fantastic here on the show. So thank you, Maddie.
Also want to thank our producers, Sam Van Halgren and Golden Joe Dassault. Our event manager as well, Tyler James Green. Without Sam, Golden Joe, and Tyler, this 400th show wouldn't go.
I mean, seriously, none of this would happen without those guys, especially Tyler over there. Let's get another round of applause for Tyler. He's been amazing. And Golden Joe back there with the clips and everything. Fantastic.
Also want to thank our volunteer production assistants, Kamaria Porter and Ray Teresi, and special thanks to Tori Malatia, Shauna Coyne, and Vanessa Harris at WBEZ. Of course, everybody here at Lincoln Hall and Chuba's who really made this possible, Judd Aiken, Matt Rusins, Paul Musaro, and our sound and lighting guys, Chris Gillen and Phil Trusky. Our featured music, of course, was from The Pear Traps. You can learn more about them at thepeartraps.bandcamp.com. Thanks also, of course, to Michael Phillips and Dana Stevens. Where can people find you online?
ChicagoTribune.com/movies.
Dana?
At Slate.com and also the Slate Culture Gab Fest podcast.
Excellent. Thanks so much, guys.
And we can't forget this amazing crowd. This was so much fun and so much easier than I thought it would be, frankly, and it's because of you guys. Thank you. Thank you for coming out and giving up your Wednesday night to be here with us. waxing philosophical about what we learned from the films. Really appreciate it. And included in this crowd, Josh, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't thank our wives. I know your wife, Debbie, is here. The real executive producers of Film Spotting. My wife, Sarah, I thought she was here, who, this is actually the first episode of Film Spotting she's ever heard. And that's not a joke. Though, she was sitting right down there, and then she disappeared
halfway
empty. Through the show. So I actually
am
not sure.
This is the first half a show she's ever heard.
Yeah.
Well, I hope she's not rethinking everything.
She might be. She might be after my picks. You never know. So, but thank you to Debbie and Sarah as well. This is it, guys, for Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kevinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.